Right now is going to be Animal Voices.
Welcome to Animal Voices. The truth is the truth, even if no one believes it. And a lie is a lie, even if everyone believes it. You are listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And this is a non-commercial, cooperatively owned, listener-supported community radio station. Yes, we are located in the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side, and Co-op Radio is a voice for the voiceless that strives to provide space for underrepresented and marginalized communities. Alan Jensen, thank you as always for being our technician. My name is Carl Loskin. Shortly we'll be speaking with Inga Hanle, who considers herself to be an activist for truth. And today we will discuss the journey from family farms to factory farms. And also in the studio today we have co-host Marge Adams. Marge, what will you be doing today?
I have an interesting guest calling in at 12:30, and her name is Sandra Wallen. She is a counselor, and she has a very different approach because she uses a horse in her healing, and I'm going to be talking to her about that.
Horses are indeed healers. Mm-hmm. So one public announcement we have is there's going to be a free public forum at the Silver Harbor Center, East 22nd Street in North Vancouver. And from 1 to 4 p.m., it's going to be about what has happened to the production of electricity in British Columbia. And last week we had Professor John Calvert on our program, and he will be speaking from 1 to 4 p.m. in North Vancouver, East 22nd, and Tom Rankin will also be speaking about saving our rivers. So we just need to organize the speakers here a little bit, and So thank you, Alan, as
always. I'm going to just play a very brief piece of music while we set the microphones up here. I'm going to play a little piece from a group called Boutin Soyon, who are from Quebec. And this is to let you know that Festival du Bois is coming to Vancouver March 7th and 8th, 2009, at Mackin Park. Don't touch the mics, please. I'll fix it all in just a sec. At Mackin Park in Coquitlam. If you want more information about Festival du Bois, just go to www.festivaldubois.ca. And we'll hear a little bit of music by Boutin Soyon while we set up the mics. Looking forward to Festival du Bois. That's sort of great music from Quebec you're going to hear. That's Boutin Soyon, and there's a whole about 10 other bands coming to Festival du Bois at Mackin Park in Coquitlam, March 7th and 8th. Like I said, you can go to festivaldubois.ca. And now to Carl and our first guest.
Yes, thank you, Alan. There has been a tremendous worldwide expansion of animal factory farms in the past decades, and this advent has had enormous implications on our environment, our health, and the well-being of the animals. In North America, most meat is from highly intensive systems. Agribusinesses and their company, related companies, have invested from source to consumer, and this is what is called vertically integrated companies. The global power of agribusiness and the burden of factory farming of animals is on the increase. The filthiest polluters in the world today are the oil, chemical, timber, mining, and agribusiness multinationals, each united by a common greenhouse gas contributory thread. Animal-based diets and modern intensive animal agriculture violate basic religious mandates to preserve our health, treat animals with compassion, protect the environment, conserve natural resources, help hungry people, and pursue peace and nonviolence. The future of the planet is imperiled by the production and consumption of animal products. The world is threatened today as perhaps never before. Anyone lucky enough to access 3 square meals a day has the power to make a tremendous impact on their ecological footprint by going veg. The collective significance of each individual choice cannot be overemphasized. A switch towards vegetarianism is a societal imperative, essential to help shift the world to a more sustainable path and to show the relevance of ancient traditions to modern crises. And that's why we today have Inge Hanle in there, because I'm going to emphasize ancient traditions to modern crises. And that maybe, Inge, epitomizes what we're moving to in our modern agricultural system here.
Thank you, Carl. I'd like to call this Farmageddon. We refer to it as Armageddon. Well, Farmageddon is part of that. And since World War II, we have seen a government policy to eradicate the local independent farmer and to have their lands foreclosed on and confiscated by the big multinational monopolies, the Monsantos, the Argills, the Aventis, and so on. I'd like to actually read an editorial that I wrote when Monsanto and Schmeiser were having their court case, and this was a comment that I made at that time. This is an issue that concerns not only farmers, but every citizen who cares about the security of the food supply. There is absolutely no doubt that the laws governing genetically engineered seeds, and for that matter, the entire farming industry, are structured so that corporations and the elite that control them are able to own and manipulate the food supply. From the individual, the right to self-sufficiency and survival is being removed. It also gives the global manipulators the ability to control and blackmail populations through engineered famines. And around the world right now, we are experiencing engineered famines. The momentum to confiscate the food supply and to designate it as property of mega multinational corporation is spearheaded by those who control the American government and use its power as a lever for global implementation. The rest of the world is trying to protect itself against the onslaught, but has to contend with the blackmailing capacity of the self-appointed corporation union, the World Trade Organization.
Now, Inge, you grew up in Quebec, and you're a senior. Now, you saw firsthand this gigantic change, because you mentioned an instance where there was the area where you lived, there were 250 family farmers there. And what is the position there right now?
Right now, there are 2 farms that are trying to hang on by their toenails. And it looks to me as though within the next 1 or 2 years, they will be gone as well.
Now, maybe you can just put into effect what you've just read there as a sort of an example of what actually happened in this town. Maybe you can mention the name of the town.
Well, it's a little town in Quebec called Mansonville, but it's the same thing right across the planet. Our entire Middle West is becoming a ghost town. What has happened is that after World War II, the U.S. Department of Agriculture put out a schematic. They put out an agenda as to exactly at what rate they would demolish the family farm. And if you go into the archives of the United States Department of Agriculture, you can find that schedule. Exactly how fast and how they would basically bankrupt the family farm and bring it to what they called the Green Revolution, right? What has happened is that they have what we call boom and bust sessions. They increase the price of commodities. They encourage farmers to invest in more machinery and get them into debt. And as soon as they are in debt, they drop the price of the commodity. The farmers go into bankruptcy and they foreclose. They have to sell. And in that way, they just simply gobble up farm after farm after farm. Now, there's another way that they do it. They control the government. Now, if you read Corrupt to the Core by Shiv Chopra, you will begin to realize that the people who are running the agencies that control agriculture and that control Health Canada and the Canadian Department of Agriculture, that they are all from the multinational industries. They play musical chairs. They make the regulations in such a way that the farmer cannot comply. The small farmer cannot comply. He does not have the resources. He doesn't have the financial resources. And what is happening is that they are outlawing the local supply of food. We used to produce almost all of our main essentials locally. 80% of the food supply in North America was locally produced just a half a century ago. Now less than 20% is. Now, how many years ago is it that we...
Now, surely they must have fought this farmers' markets thing that is really widespread in many suburbs in Vancouver.
Farmers' markets are a drop in the bucket. The amount of food that is sold at farmers' markets compared to what is sold through your big stores like Save On Foods and Overweighty and whatever, it's a drop in the bucket.
So when we look at the Fraser Valley, even in the 30, 40 years that I've been living in the Lower Mainland, there used to be, even 30, 20 years ago, there were many family farmers. And I always had that phrase when I drove through there and spoke to people, is that we wanted family farms, not factory farms. And you, of course, spoke about Bruce Dickinson's book, Farmageddon, which is upon us. But what I find most difficult to accept is that we've destroyed the natural environment. We have our vegetables and fruit, and in many cases the tomato is a fruit, everything grown in unnaturally climatized hothouses. But maybe you can just comment on the idea that we've in fact destroyed with our new agricultural system, that we've destroyed what is in fact very essential for life on earth and our life, and that we have destroyed what is natural.
Well, absolutely. I'd like to go into something called vertical integration. You have to remember that the big multinationals are really the same people that own the chemical companies. What has happened is the big multinationals have decided that they will own everything from the seed right up to the time that you're consuming something. And this means that they control the seed, they control the crop, they control who it's fed to, they control who consumes it. Now, after World War II, the biggest multinational companies that supplied chemicals for warfare had no outlet. Therefore, the nerve gases that were sold in World War II now became the insecticides with which we have blanketed the entire planet. Now, these insecticides are all neurotoxins. They kill the nervous system, anything that comes in contact with it. Now, their interest is not in producing food. Their interest is in selling the chemicals. And then their second interest is to make sure that they control the farms so that there is no impediment to using as many chemicals as they want to.
Now, when we control the farms, we also can control and let people be acceptance of vaccinating poultry, for one, treating animals with hormones, all kinds of hormones, and so many people are buying this?
Well, as Dr. Chopra said, 50 years ago, Canada had one of the safest food supplies on the planet. Now we have one of the worst, because we have not been able to stop agriculture, the people who breed the animals in these factory farms. We have not been able to stop them from using antibiotics. We have not been able to stop them from injecting hormones. We have not been able to stop them from using the insecticides and everything, every other chemical that there is. And I might point out that the hormones that they feed in these factory farms are the hormones that are still in the meat. I have noticed lately, when I look at 4- and 5- and 6-year-old girls, that they're already building breasts, something that you used to see in a 12-year-old. Prostate cancer in men is skyrocketing. Breast cancer in women is skyrocketing because these hormones, which are fed to the animals to increase their weight, are all estrogenic, and they all will cause cancer of the reproductive organs. And so it's not just a matter of saying, oh, well, that goes to the animals. When you eat those animals, you are getting those hormones. You are getting those antibiotics. And when you feed an animal antibiotics all the time, you are absolutely certain to develop antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And if you're wondering where these superbugs are coming from, look to your factory farm. Look to your government regulators. And I might say, if you do nothing else, get Shiv Chopra's book, Corrupt to the Core. He will tell you exactly what's happening in Health Canada and the veterinary division of Health Canada, and in everything that controls what is what can be fed and what is happening on factory farms.
Now, we're speaking with Inga Hanley. She's well known on Co-op Radio, and she's an activist for truth. Wonderful to have you. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO 102.7 FM. Now, you've spoken about pesticides, Inga, and of course there's the Terminator technology, but what always amazes me is that when I speak to people on the street, they put forward the idea, much like the global warming deniers. I mean, it's as if they're the spokespeople for the oil industry. And this is the same thing we're having with pesticides. Only last week, we had an article in one of the leading Canadian newspapers with people with degrees strung behind their name saying that these pesticides are harmless. And this is this gigantic influence, and I think that's that you're saying it absolutely right, because of this, the absolute power and vertical integration that they sway the minds of the people.
Okay, I may get into that because you have fallen for a hoax as well.
I love it.
Because the global climate warming hoax is precisely that. No one is mentioning the fact that most of this dramatic change in our climate is being partially steered by HARP, chemtrails, and a whole lot of other things that they have the technology to do. They can literally control and fabricate the weather. Okay. And no one is telling you that. Now, the catastrophes are happening, but they are not a natural occurrence.
Okay, we're fully aware that global warming is happening. But the only difference is with people saying where it's coming from. Are we correct with
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's just stick to that.
But it's coming from the same people who are doing this. It is coming from the same sources.
Okay, what we'd like to stick with here is, of course, what's happening with the whole production of our food. So maybe we can just keep to that. And you consider yourself to be, in many ways, you've been challenged many ways on many aspects, because you consider yourself to be somewhat of a freedom fighter, and you challenge the existing order. But maybe you can tell us some of the sort of incidences where you've really struggled to bring something over as far as this destruction of the family farms in Canada, and that it's what we're hearing from you is that it's brought on and motivated by industry as a global strategy.
Absolutely. Now, what has happened, for instance, in the country of Iraq, when we have gone in as an occupier nation, the first thing that Brenner did was to mandate that the farmers in Iraq can no longer plant their own seeds. They must buy their seeds from the likes of Monsanto and Cargill and whatever the other companies' names are. So already they have mandated that people cannot do what they've done for centuries and centuries and centuries. In other words, grow their crops, collect their seeds, and replant. In Iraq, that's illegal now. And now, it's also illegal in a lot of the third world countries. Now, how are they bringing genetically engineered seeds in there by the back door? They're forcing these starving people to accept the dumping of our genetically engineered grains into their country. Once you have genetically engineered grain on your soil and in your soil, you will never get it out. All of North America is now contaminated with genetically engineered seeds. You cannot get it out of the environment. Now, I want to tell you something else. Survival. The genetic engineered crops are literally killing the soil. 10 years of genetically engineered crops and you have dead soil that won't produce anything. Why? Because the BT that is in and the chemicals that are being engineered into these crops are killers. BT kills things, right? It is a natural, it is a built-in insecticide. So therefore, when these plants compost back into the soil, they kill all of the microbiological entities in the soil. Now you have dead soil.
Now, of course, when the animals eat these foods, the chemicals bioaccumulate. So when we're eating the flesh of the animal, we're getting bigger doses of it. But Inga, maybe you've been an activist for 30 years, maybe. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what you consider to be the validity of Health Canada and maybe the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Are they doing what you think they should be doing?
They are totally in the hands. They are run by the multinational companies. As Shiv Chopra says, he was told unequivocally by the government that his clients were not the citizens of Canada. His clients were the companies. Everything runs on economy now. And if you can make money killing something, then that's fine. That raises the amount of money that is being made. Economy is simply making money. It doesn't matter how you make it. And now we're making money killing people.
Now, there's many conspiracy theories, but of course, to me, it's not a conspiracy theory about the Bilderbergers, the Illuminati, and everything. Maybe you can put this all into a larger perspective, maybe a global perspective.
A theory? When all the evidence is there for you to look at?
Well, maybe you can tell us this.
Well, when does a theory become fact? When the facts are there as clear evidence. Now, it's great if you have spin doctors, and if they can spin out, oh, that's a theory, that's a conspiracy, you know, just overload the media with these phrases, these one-liners, these little cliches, and the public buys it. The evidence is there. We have an agricultural system that is killing the animals that are being fed, and it's killing the people that are eating the crops and the animals. Now, let me go into the BT. The BT is an organism which used to be used actually in agriculture to counteract caterpillars because it destroys the mucous membrane inside the caterpillar. Now, why would you think that something that destroys the mucous membrane in a caterpillar wouldn't destroy the mucous membrane somewhere else? And so consequently, a BT corn and any other plant that has BT engineered into it produces BT toxin in every single cell of that plant. It is a perpetual insecticide production. When you eat those crops, you will disturb the mucous membrane of your digestive system.
Now, Inga, we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes left, and you've given us a wealth of thought-provoking information here. Maybe you could just summarize what you've said in the last 20 minutes and send us all away totally agog at what we've landed ourselves with here in the agricultural and factory farming issues of today.
Well, what I want to leave you with is that you do have power. Many of us will go into a supermarket and we'll buy the cheapest thing. If it comes from Mexico or Chile or wherever it is, it doesn't matter how it's produced. You have to begin to realize that what you buy cheap is not cheap. If it destroys your health, it is not cheap. If it destroys the local industry, it is not cheap. If it destroys your children, it is not cheap. It's only cheap when you look at it in the with the price tag on the label. You have to realize that you must walk with your feet. You must support local agriculture. You must fight the government to make sure that the organic standards are not watered down. So right now, the Monsantos are trying to change the organic standards so that they can comply. And so, in other words, organic is slowly not meaning anything. You have to vote by calling up these companies. And many of the companies in many countries have stopped selling genetically engineered food, for instance, because the consumer came in with hundreds of thousands of consumers calling up and saying, we won't shop in your store anymore. You have power. For God's sake, use it.
Thank you, Inga Hanley, for being the fiery activist that I always thought you were. And today you were able to express it so beautifully on Animal Voices. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. And I have a little story here, Inga. You might like this. And it's a story about the humble fly. And it says, when enough flies sting you at a picnic, you get up and move. A human being is big and a fly is small. But when insects join together to make a nuisance, they are powerful indeed. And you know what? You've inspired us to be powerful. Thank you, Inga. And
if we want to survive, we have to start taking the power back into our own hands.
Thank you, Inga.
It's a matter of survival.
Good, good. Marge, Alan, maybe just a little bit of music here. Thank you. And over to Inga Hanley again. Here you are.
I would just like to end with an observation that Cicero made at 43 years before Christ was born. A nation can survive its fools and even its ambitions, but it cannot survive treason from within. And what we are experiencing is treason from within. An enemy at the gates is less formidable, for he is known and carries his banner openly. But the traitor moves amongst us within the gates freely, his sly whispers rustling through the alleys, heard in the very halls of government itself. For the traitor appears not as a traitor. He speaks in accents familiar to his victims, and he wears their face and their arguments. He appeals to their baseness that lies deep in the heart of all men. He rots the soul of a nation. He works secretly and unknown in the night to undermine the pillars of the city. He infects the polite, the body politic, so that it can no longer resist. A murderer is less to be feared than the traitor within.
Thank you, Inga, for coming into the studio and for the information you've provided to us. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And many of our radio programs are listed on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And over to Marge.
Thank you, Carl. My guest today is Sandra Wallen, who has a Master of Arts degree in counseling and is a registered clinical counselor. She is a school counselor in the school district of Coquitlam and has a private practice in Maple Ridge. Sandra is different from most counselors in that she engages the healing powers of the horse when working with clients. Welcome to Animal Voices, Sandra.
Well, thank you very much, Marge. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, we're very pleased to have you. Perhaps we could start, Sandra, by having you tell us what the qualities of the horse possesses. What are the qualities that the horse possesses that enables them to help heal humans? Could you answer that first?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Well, I think in my own experience growing up, I always had this connection and this affinity for horses, and I never necessarily had an opportunity to be around them, but I had this yearning and longing to be with them. And I think it's something that if you talk with many women that they identify with, that as an attribute that they had when they were young. So there's this attraction to the beauty and the archetype, I think, that horses represent of freedom and power and passion. And at the same time, there's this benevolence and this very large heartfulness with which they engage with humanity, mm-hmm. considering the woes and the mistreatment that we've shared and shown them over the years.
Yes. Do you work with one horse in particular, or do you have several that you use, perhaps depending on the client?
Well, I always caution myself against the word use, because my horses are truly my partners mm-hmm. in the work that I share with people. I have three horses here that share my life with myself and with my family. But when I travel, I actually work with horses that I've never met, and sometimes there are people that have one or two horses, and at other times there are people that have a whole herd of horses. For example, my friends that run BC Horse Vacations, they have 16 horses that we have the luxury of working with when we do workshops up there.
And do they all respond to you and to the client in different ways, or are there certain things you look for in the horse that you're working with at the time?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the benefits of working in the field of equine guided development, or some people call it equine assisted learning or equine facilitated therapy, that it doesn't matter whether the horse is young or old or has a particular handicap. Like, I know I've worked with some horses that are blind in one eye. When we do this work, it's truly honoring of the nature of the horse, which is transcendent of what their personal and physical abilities are, I should say. So we can learn something from all horses, which I think in and of itself is a great lesson for us as well.
Yeah. Now, when you first told me about this, your practice, I was a little bit puzzled about the prospective clients. Now, they perhaps all of them know that you do work with horses, but a prospective client, I would wonder, are some of them pretty nervous about a horse?
Some people have never been around horses, mm-hmm. and yet they still know that there's this calling for them to be able to go out and spend time with them. And mm-hmm. some women will call me and say, I've been reading about horses, and I've been dreaming about horses, and I'm terrified of horses, and yet at the same time, I know I'm supposed to come out and be with them. And then there's the other end of the scale. There's people that have worked with and been around horses and grown up loving them all their lives and know that there's this place within the space of being with horses that holds an unlimited capacity for growth and healing.
Does the horse put these more anxious clients at ease?
I think, again, it depends a bit on the horse and what their gifts are. Uh-huh. I certainly have one horse here. Actually, I have two horses here in particular that are very, very good at helping people feel comfortable in their presence. And even though they're very large creatures, along with that, they have this wonderfully large awareness and wonderful space and heart place that they work with people. And that being said, you know, I've also worked doing team building and corporate development with groups from Microsoft and individual corporations and team building up here. And so the horses can work in this beautiful, gentle heart space, and yet they can also work with people that are working on becoming leaders and working at communication effectively amongst teams. So they're very, very versatile in their teachings.
You certainly have a variety of ages, don't you, with your clients?
Yes, actually, I work with children in the school system. Actually, it started in the Coquitlam School District, where I would bring some of the students that were on my caseload out to work with the horses. And some of those students were actually children that are dealing with autism. And so it was wonderful to be able to see them engage with the horse when our experience with them at school was such that they rarely made eye contact. They certainly weren't tactile in terms of wanting to touch many of the things that came into their environment. But when they were working with the horses, I saw this one little boy just reach his hand out and put his hand up on the shoulder of this horse that we were working with. And he just breathed deeper, and he looked up at the horse, and he made eye contact, and it was, it kind of took our breath away, I have to say.
That's wonderful. There are different problems, I suppose, that, like the one you've just mentioned, that lend themselves especially well to having the horse present there, and you interpret the body language of the horse, I understand, and the reaction of the animal.
I sometimes act as a translator, that's
okay.
For sure, but mm-hmm. I think the crux and the heart of the experience lays in the experience that happens between the person and the horse. And sometimes I'll act as interpreter and sometimes I'll act as guide, but for the most part, it's very individual what each person experiences within each session. And actually, my mare, Grace, is very, she's very bossy in terms of she will literally put herself between me and the person she's working with. Sometimes it's like she's putting this wall up that she doesn't want me to be able to see what's going on. And she'll place her body between us so that it's her private session. And then I get to find out what happened at the end.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing. You mentioned to me when we were speaking on the telephone about the horse being in the now, and that's the way they want the people to be who are present. Tell us about that.
Well, I know this is true in terms of I'll come sometimes home from work if I've been in the school district and I've been fighting traffic to get home, and I'll want to go out and spend time with the horses. And my young horse in particular is very, very aware of whether I'm present or not. And when what I mean by that is if I'm thinking about the day or if I'm worrying about tomorrow and what I have to do, he will push into my space like it doesn't even exist, and he'll come and he'll nudge on me, and my mare Grace will actually ignore me until she feels that I'm fully present and back home.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And here's a question not about the horse, but about other animals. Are there other animals that could be interpreting the problems of people and responding to them that are used in therapy?
Well, I know that the Delta Society is very well known for working with other animals. I think particularly they work with dogs. There's actually, I just heard about a lady here in Maple Ridge who's running a pig sanctuary, and I understand that she's working with pigs in human development as well. And, I mean, in my mind, I think that one of the principles that we talk about in equine guided development, as taught by one of my amazing teachers, Barbara Rector, is that the horses really do act as a mirror. And if we think of our environment and that what we give out, we get back, we can look at anything in our lives and learn from the reflection or the experiences that are coming back. So if we hold that as a possibility to be true, mm-hmm. then it would make sense that all animals, all encounters, all experiences would hold learning for us.
Mm-hmm, yes. Now, do you have some experience with the horses that you'd like to tell us about? Stories?
Well, actually, one that just popped to my mind just mm-hmm. as you say that, I spoke a couple years ago at the Body Heals Conference, which is a conference for physicians who practice integrative medicine. And I spoke on the healing power of horses at that conference. And I was speaking particularly about one of my horses who has a particular gift in working with people. And I had a friend come out. He called me and he said, I'm supposed to come out. I'm not really sure why. I've never been around horses before, but I know I'm supposed to come out and spend time with you and your horses. And he had just been diagnosed with testicular cancer. And so when he came out, we walked out to meet with the horses, and generally all the horses kind of buzz around. It's a new person. They want to come and say hi. But none of the other horses approached him except Grace. They all sort of, I should say there was just two other horses, not like a whole herd, mm-hmm. but they stood off to the side. And Grace walked directly right up to him, and she put her head right down where his cancer was located. And she stood there, and she just breathed. She stood there for about 10 to 15 minutes, just breathing her breath right into this area of his body, not looking at any other place there. And my friend turned to me, he was a little aghast, and he said, oh, my goodness, is this okay? And I said, yeah, it's okay. Just stand there, just be comfortable, and just see what she has to share. And so she did that, and then after about 10 or 15 minutes, she just broke off the connection, and she turned and walked away. Hmm. And he turned to me and said, I think that she must know. I said, well, I wouldn't be at all surprised if that were the case. So he interpreted that as Grace giving him a gift of healing. That she focused in on his body where he had that cancer happening. And at this point, he's now cancer-free. So
really?
He certainly attributes all the wonderful things he did to in his healing practice, but he includes Grace in that as well.
Imagine that.
Well, dogs can, too. Mm-hmm. Dogs can sense cancer.
Absolutely. There's a lot of studies that have shown dogs being able to smell out cancer in different areas of the body.
Interesting. Do doctors sometimes recommend you to their patients?
Not at this point. However, I am hoping to be able to. I've been working in conjunction with Dr. Beverly Kane from Stanford Medical School, who runs a program called Medicine and Horses. And Dr. Warren Bell up here has agreed to be my champion and try to help me get a program such as hers that would be run out at UBC. So that's one of my goals and aspirations, is hopefully by 2010 to have a medicine and horses program running up here at one of our medical schools in the province.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Another thing you mentioned was horses help us remember. And now can you tell us what that was all about?
I don't remember the context. We were talking about that the other day. I think it was in terms of...
They bring up memories, something of the past, I guess.
I think the context was that we were talking about how they help us remember to be the best that we know ourselves to be, because horses ask us to be congruent and present and authentic and honest and living in present time. And honest about, I think that when we are in those places, it's like remembering the best of who we are, because I think sometimes as life progresses, we move away from that core balanced place. And so when we spend time with horses, mm-hmm. they bring us back to that place of groundedness, connectedness, heartfulness, peacefulness, consciousness.
And honesty.
And honesty, absolutely.
Yeah, well, this is really a fascinating subject that we're covering today. And I know that, perhaps you have other stories you could tell us, but I don't want to forget about recommending your website and telephone number to our listeners in
Thank
case
you.
They'd like to contact you. Could we do that right now?
That's
and maybe
lovely.
The end?
Thank you very much. It's www.kyronsway.com. And Kyron's Way is spelled CHIRONSWAY. And my number is 604-462-9182. And I certainly welcome any and all inquiries about incorporating horses into one's own healing. And actually, I also teach classes for people that are interested in incorporating horses into their professional practice as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, there's a whole new area. And you get to, professional practitioners, people who are dealing with clients, I suppose, and this will broaden them,
educators, people that are working with educational issues, therapeutic mm-hmm. issues, medical and wellness issues. So anyone that works in the sort of the helping, the big umbrella would be the helping field. horses are here to help.
Mm-hmm. Good. Now, give us, if you are able to, we've been getting a lot of information from you, but one last story.
One last story.
Well, I'll ask you a question because I had a friend who came to visit you, and of course, most people think that this person is quite sensitive. His name's actually Eric, and he's listening, and he said that he knew instantly which horse he was going to communicate with, or but it actually was that you had a number of horses there, three horses, but what you said was that the horse chose Eric. And because that's a quantum difference, because we always see ourselves as the epicenter of the universe.
Imagine that we didn't think otherwise. That would be wonderful. Well, the horses, particularly this horse that chose Eric, and hi, Eric, likes to very much be the center of this universe. So she's very, very clear about who she would like to work with and who she would not like to work with. And it doesn't take someone who knows horse language at all to be able to discern the difference.
Was that Grace by any chance?
That is Grace. That is my Grace, yes.
Her
name is actually a Grace Remembered, her registered name, and I think it's such a perfect name for her because that's really what she does help people do, is remember that gracefulness, which touches on what we were just talking about.
Ah, yes, very nice.
But, yeah, I think one of my teachers, again, Barbara Rector, calls it con su permiso, or with your permission, and I call it looking for the invitation, that I think we're so used to just going up to horses and putting our hand on them and giving them a rub and giving them a smack, and we don't really look for being invited into their space to begin with, and then secondly, how do they want us to approach them, and how do they want us to engage with them? And it's such a powerful teaching, particularly I'm finding for teens that are learning how to negotiate that friendship, boyfriend, girlfriend place in their lives.
Really?
And also for women that have been perhaps mistreated along the way, to be able to learn how to, first of all, see what a strong, healthy lead mare expects of the people and horses around her, and second of all, then how to establish on her own those healthy boundaries. And my young horse, Kyron, can certainly teach you how to have healthy boundaries, because he likes to ignore them unless they're nice and strong.
Uh-huh. Wonderful lessons to be learned from horses. That's most encouraging. And I think that's a really interesting point you've just made about battered women. I think this could be a wonderful service for these women who are suffering from broken marriages and abuse. I can really see a horse helping them.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great idea. Well, Sandra, thank you so very much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and good luck in your practice. I think that you've got a great deal to offer.
Thank you so much, Marge, and thank you, Carl, very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You have been listening to an interview with Sandra Wallen, who is a counselor and works for the Coquitlam School Board, as well as has a private practice in Maple Ridge. And we'll just repeat her website, www.karensway.com. Now I'll
Kyron's Way.
Kyron, that's right. CHIRONSWAY.com. And her telephone number, 604-462-9182.
Thank you, Marge. That was great. And she has such a wonderful, gentle voice. You just, there's so much sincerity written in there. Well, you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And Alan, maybe you have a little bit of music for us.
Here we'll hear just a little bit of this piece by John Reichman called Ponies in the Forest, sort of to follow that interview about horses. was Ponies in the Forest by John Reichman. I just a few days ago, got an email from the Stanley Park Ecology Society about the heron, the great blue heron colony in Stanley Park, which is very interesting. It was a major colony of great blue herons that live in Stanley Park. And this time of the year, at late February, is the time when they start coming back to the colony and start to repair their nests and get ready for the next year. Last year in the Stanley Park colony, there were 151 nests. Like, it's a big colony in Stanley Park. Most people probably don't realize, but if you just go down around where the tennis courts are in Stanley Park and look around, you'll see all these nests up in the trees. This time of year especially, most of them are deciduous trees, and in the summertime, the leaves, all in spring, all the leaves go, and it's hard to see the nests. But right now, you can see all the nests there. These big, they're up near the tops of the trees, and they're made of sticks, the nests. And these big nests are all over the place up in those trees. And they had those 151 nests last year produced 212 new herons. There was 212 young herons born who actually were fledged and made it out of the nest. Well, actually, last year was not as good as the previous year when 340, which I think is a record for Stanley Park, 340 new herons came out the year before. There's many things that influence whether the heron rookery is successful. And one thing are the raccoons, because they'll climb up the trees and eat the heron's eggs, and that's a real problem. And Stanley Park has a problem with too many raccoons because people feed them all the time. People don't get, there's signs around the park saying don't feed the wild animals, but people don't get it. They keep feeding the raccoons, and the population of the raccoons gets too big, and they wander all over the place looking for food. Anyway, so this heron rookery has been in this area near the tennis courts for several years now, for about 7 or 8 years. It used to be elsewhere in the park, but they moved over to where they are now, the birds did, because it's even though it's in a more public area, it's safer for them there, because they were bothered a lot in the past by eagles. Bald eagles would come in the late spring and steal the chicks out of the nest. But the eagles are less likely to come when they're, at least the herons seem to be thinking so, when they're nearer where people are around. Anyway, Carl, you have something else.
Yes. Talking about birds, of course, when is a good time to go to Rayfield Bird Sanctuary? And there's also a sanctuary in North Vancouver, the Maple Flats.
Maplewood, yes.
Maplewood
Flats. Actually, right now, yeah, I should say, if you go to Rayfield Sanctuary, which is out in Ladner, any Sunday morning at 10, every Sunday morning at 10, John Ireland, the sanctuary manager, gives tours, and anybody can, you just pay your $4 admission to get into the sanctuary, and you can go on the tour with John Ireland, and he is great. He knows the birds so well, and he knows the sanctuary so well, and he can answer any questions, and it's a very good thing to do. So you can go to Rifle any day of the week, and like Maplewood in North End, that's just over the Second Narrows Bridge and towards Deep Cove a little bit, along the Dollarton Highway. And both places are very worth visiting. Both are non-profit bird sanctuary areas. Maplewood has no admission at all, but Rifle is such a big operation that they need to charge an admission. But it's well worth the $4 because it's huge and it's fascinating. Right now, I should say, in Rifle, the snow geese are there, and there are thousands of snow geese around Rifle right now.
I was very impressed by the idea that there's also an area where hunting and shooting of ducks is permitted, but that the ducks that come there on their migratory path, that have been there before, they know where it's safe and where it isn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Elsewhere around the, there's a big areas around Boundary Bay, which is very near there, that hunting is permitted. But you're right. There's a lot of ducks and geese there, and swans and other birds as well. Right now, there's a lot of swans around there as well, trumpeter swans, because they know it's safe.
What I find so tragic about shooting one of these birds is that many of these birds, they mate for life. Mm-hmm. And when you, I mean, it's like, imagine losing your partner or your loved one.
It's the same with other animals, too. And it's same with some of the big game animals in British Columbia, it's particularly true. And it's such a tragedy that the government here in BC still allows big game hunting of grizzlies and of bighorn sheep and these other animals, which are low in numbers and they mate, some of them, mate, they have their own sort of social system, right? And it is, it's an outrage to me that this still happens. I mean, duck hunting, is not a good thing either, but it's not like the big game hunting.
No, but it's putting lead in the water, isn't it?
Well, nowadays, most hunters use shot that doesn't have lead in it, because you're right, the lead has killed millions of birds. The lead, this stays, it, even if they miss the bird, right, it lands in the rest of the shot lands in the bottom of the water, and it sits there. And then when the geese and the swans and the other birds come along and eat stuff off the bottom, they end up ingesting this, and like one pellet of lead will kill a bird, right? And and so some of these lakes have just tons of lead in them, but now most hunters don't use lead.
Now, Alan, in the Fraser Estuary there, there's also the Delta Port, and there's a projected quadrupling of the Delta Port and the building of that highway. And that's very close to this very sensitive bird area, and it involves scooping up all the soil up to build the port from the estuary, which is a natural feeding ground from millions of years of soil coming down the Fraser River.
Yeah, there's many birds, not just the ducks and geese, too. A lot of the shorebirds like sandpipers, and there's like the great blue herons I was talking about earlier. Many, many, if you go there this time of year, especially at low tide, you'll see hundreds of great blue herons out there, because there's a big rookery at Point Roberts, as well as the one in Stanley Park. And so many herons go along that very area to get their food, as well as like the smaller birds, like the sandpipers, and then all the ducks and geese.
There's also a rookery right near UBC, isn't there?
It's a smaller one out there. Yeah.
Now, is the Gateway project still on its way?
Unfortunately, yes. Hopefully, when the upcoming provincial election, the Liberals will get ushered out, and the NDP would change. I hope. I'm not sure what their policy is, but it's got to be to change
got
that
to
ridiculous
mm-hmm.
policy. Anyway, we have about no time left. You're going to have to sign off.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voice. You've been listening to Animal Voices. I'd like to close off with, remember that we've had Inga Hanley here speaking about the change of factory farms to family farms to factory farms and the changes in agriculture. And basically, it's we're so gullible in many ways. And I started the program with a quote, and I'll end it that way. And I said that the truth is the truth, even if no one believes it. And a lie is a lie, even if everyone believes it. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices.
Animal research gives experimenters a paycheck, but it doesn't give us cures for human illnesses. Using animals is costly, it's cruel, inefficient, and it's old-fashioned. Sophisticated non-animal research methods using whole human DNA, for example, is where our money should go. Help us insist on modern research. Rate People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's PETA, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
And wrapping up this hour, I'd like to remind you that Radio EcoShock is coming up imminently, right away, and that's going to be followed at 2 o'clock by Community Living and at 2:30 by the A-Train, just to help you sail through the afternoon. I'd also like to remind you that Co-op Radio is a listener-supported station, listener-sponsored, no big advertisers here, and our semi-annual fundraising drive is coming in about 6 weeks' time, in mid-April, so watch out for that, put some money aside, and support Co-op Radio.
I was managing my assets late one night when my eyes beheld a dreadful sight. The economy began to destabilize, and suddenly, to my surprise,
the market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
No one could borrow cash.
The market crashed.
It collapsed in a flash.
The market crashed.
Holy Hannah, the wheels are coming off the gilded wagon of capitalism. This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm at least one Alex Smith, maybe two. Part of me is excited that the zombie system killing the planet has cracked open. My other side is fearful. I like peaceful streets and grocery stores with food in them. Damn it, I'm cheering and weeping for both sides.
From the corner, office, and executive suite, to a trading floor and throughout Wall Street, everybody came from their humble abodes to salvage what they could while the system implodes.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
Over the last 3 years of weekly podcasts and radio broadcasts, I've had the good fortune to interview top experts. Like many of you, I've nervously scanned both the bad economic prospects and the worst threats of climate change. Well, let's have a little chat. After last week's program, where I realized the climate has already tipped, I briefly considered ending Radio EcoShock. Part of my mission was to save the climate, to stop the change. Now, with the latest science in, I don't think that is possible. We have inadvertently tipped a switch that will end up, as James Hansen says, with a different planet. Just with the greenhouse gas emissions already released and committed by our dependence on coal and oil, the irreversible melting of the polar ice has begun, along with the world's glaciers. It's just a matter of how fast, how bad, and can we adapt. In this time together, I'll give you some of my best guesses and my own puny plans and chatter from the net.
Not even acknowledging what I would say the majority of smart economists are saying, which is that the United States banking system is insolvent.
Angry voices and marching feet. The last thing a government facing a financial crisis wants to have to deal with.
Is it coincidence that the financial world has collapsed just as we learn our climate fate? I don't think so. The same people who looted our pension funds and banks were allied with the fossil fuel and automotive lobbies that quashed the early warnings on climate. Even deeper, 3 out of 4 Americans now know how serious climate is. They've seen it in the fires, the floods, the droughts, the storms. A poll done by Rasmussen Reports found that 23% of Americans, 1 in 4, say it is somewhat likely that global warming will destroy human civilization within the next century. So we know. In the early arrival of the birds, the strange weather, we know and we have lost confidence in both the system and ourselves. This is no return to normal. There is only adaptation to constant change. You and I need to prepare for turbulent times on 2 different but related paths. We hope to stay fed in our homes in the short term. Yet some of us may have to move as climate migrants in the coming decade or two. We'll call it the 3-month strategy and the 3-year plan. That is coming up along with another installment of my audio blog on long-term food storage, where Alex finds out that not everything goes as expected.
And it means doing something very, very radical, admitting total failure.
Basic to all this is the idea that you need to move from being an information consumer, a witness to tragic times, as exciting as they are, to become an actor in your own life and community. I know how easy it is to sit spellbound at the screen watching unheard-of events unfold, but one of the most astounding results will be people thrown awake from the former system. Just as Soviet communism fell, we are now engaged in a similar disruption, the fall of greed is good capitalism. The replacement could be better or worse, and that is where you come in. Whether you build a better world or just choose to survive in a sustainable way, it is time to get engaged, don't you think? The corporate system has always demanded most of our life energy. People work crazy hours, sometimes at 2 or 3 jobs, just to get all the symbols of wealth we were promised. Hardly an idle hour was left, and those were filled with mindless entertainment for our worn-out brains and bodies. Now the system is letting us go, by the millions. Even the media is breaking apart. We are back on our own, to do as we will. I challenge myself to learn and act for survival while building sustainable community around me. You too. When it comes to the economy, the Gilded Age has passed. Even mass media admits the world's banking system is insolvent, beyond the resources of any government. Like the airliner hitting the birds, pilot Obama is trying to ditch in the Hudson River with a minimum loss of lives. In my opinion, he's chosen the wrong people to do it. Most of the financial advisors are coming from the same Wall Street crowd who screwed the system. Tim Geithner was the head of the New York Federal Reserve, one of the chief enablers of the subprime mess and the off-book gambling by banks. Who did Obama pick to oversee the restructuring of the American auto industry? Another Wall Street honcho, Steve Rattner, the co-founder of Quadrangle Group, one of the leveraged bio companies who did so much damage to corporate debt loads. Oh yeah, Rattner just happens to be a top Democratic Party fundraiser as well. Are there no experts outside Wall Street and outside the Democratic insiders?
Are these the words of the all-powerful boards and syndicates of the earth?
The latest plan is to give hedge funds, those jackals, $1 trillion of taxpayers' money to buy out worthless paper assets from the banks. Oh, that's going to work. That after the administration pulled its previous bank rescue plan at the last moment. It seems inevitable that the big American banks like Citi and Bank of America will be nationalized, meaning those multi-trillion dollar holes of bad debt and imaginary money will all be laid on the shoulders of the taxpayer. It's a last-ditch desperate gamble. I like my regular three meals a day. I like finding supplies at the store when I want them. My old life was pretty good. So part of me hopes that Obama's magic could stall off the crash as long as he can. Every day is a good day, but in my opinion, no, we can't. The old economy was a planet killer, based on greed and lies, and it is failing as we speak. Maybe the illusion will continue for a year or two, but the patient has already passed on. That means big changes for you and I, whether we like it or not, and mostly, we won't.
There was a sea change in the financial system from which we have not recovered.
There may be an upside. Those millions of unemployed and millions soon to be homeless will be free to get active in the community and in the streets. That could end up with a demand for fascism or a great leader syndrome, but there's an equal chance that the big systems will crash, revealing more local organization and some hope. Already we are seeing giant corporations like General Motors in their death throes along with the hated Hummer. We are also seeing national governments dissolve, unable to form a government in Iceland, Israel, Latvia, the Ukraine, possibly even in Britain. Of course, such national chaos and weakness is common in many developing countries, which may not develop so much after all. There's a new thing I'm trying to emphasize here. The bigger they come, the harder they fall. Municipal governments, weak and in debt as they are, may become much more important in your life and your life support systems. And new micro-networks will spring up based on faith or community or other values and causes, but they will come together. People will come together.
The financial crisis became so bad. You know, some of the news during some of the weekends were absolutely terrifying. That around the world, people just said something terrible may be happening.
It's interesting to recognize the ladder of homelessness that's now coming about. People try and sell to buy lower-cost housing, but no one can get financing. Many lose their homes and go to renting. If key jobs are lost, the next step can be a travel trailer or an old gas-guzzling motorhome parked in an RV park, or even on a side road. The RV parks are already filling up their monthly rental spaces right now. Then, it's a tent. Even before this crash, a series of tent cities appeared in America. For example, around the Seattle area, after a period of police harassment, there is now a rotating system of tent cities. The tenters get a field or a big churchyard for 3 months in one area and then have to move to another part of the region, so I'm told. Of course, this makes education for the kids nearly impossible. Church groups and other community organizations are arranging gardening spots and daily food runs for these homeless people, some of whom were recently middle class. I expect we'll see more of that. For what it's worth, I think your family should have a tent, and the equipment to cook there in case of any emergency, whether it's financial, climatic, or a natural earthquake. Add that to your planning list, a tent, sleeping bags, a tarp, metal cookware.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating? Or is it only mine?
But this is not the future my mother warned me about.
Most of us with an income face a different challenge. Should we stay where we are or prepare to move soon? It's a fight or flight kind of thing. I found a good chain of discussion under the title Survival Retreat versus Neighborhood Survival by Dr. Richard. It appeared on theoildrum.com, originating at virginiapreppersnetwork.blogspot.com. That's virginiapreppersnetwork.blogspot.com on February 11, 2009. Richard writes, and I quote, "There are four major flaws in the survival retreat separate from your home concept. One, there are significant liabilities and social problems with communal retreats. Where one does not own the property, you are vulnerable to the actions of the others, particularly the property owner. Two, property left unattended at retreats is vulnerable to theft and vandalism. This is going to be a growing problem as the economic depression gets worse, especially if we have economic collapse. Three, getting to the retreat would be problematic in the event that it is actually needed, particularly in martial law scenarios where the military and law enforcement block traffic at key intersections or in cases where there are fuel shortages. Think Katrina, I add. Four, relatively undeveloped retreats with a trailer and undeveloped land may not be sufficiently developed for long-term survival and offer insufficient space for storage of the various preps and other items you may need. Many of these items would likely be at your day-to-day residence, and you cannot assume that you can transport everything at the last minute. My view, says Richard, is that survival retreats only work if you live there full-time. Furthermore, although remote locations are further removed from the masses, they are also further removed from jobs, markets, customers, hospitals, and many other useful infrastructure, and will be harder-pressed to gather a sufficiently large group to cover all of the tasks needed in a true long-term survival scenario." That's an end of a quote from Dr. Richard at virginiapreppersnetwork.blogspot.com. I agree with him, basically. In my own case, there is no hope of selling off this condo, no buyers and no money. So we have taken a two-tracked approach here. First of all, we are now homesteading where we live, right in the city. I'll talk about that. We also had the foresight a few years ago to buy a trailer in a small village in the mountains. We do have a place
to factory farms and the changes in agriculture. And basically, it's... we're so gullible in many ways. And I started the program with a quote, and I'll end it that way. And I said that the truth is the truth, even if no one believes it. And a lie is a lie, even if everyone believes it.